This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanner studio today is Catherine Forrester, who about 10 years ago published a book called At Home, Charleston. It's based upon her grandmother and her mother's experiences at entertaining on Church Street in the Holy City. And I just became aware of it through mutual friends and found it a fascinating combination of memoir and culinary treats. And so, Catherine, welcome to the Journal.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Why don't you tell us how this book came about?
Well, in 1949, my grandmother wrote a little pamphlet of recipes that she self-published, and it was called A Cookbook for Gay. That was my mother's name, and it was about a year before mother was married, and it included a lot of old family recipes. And over the years, she gave it to many people in Charleston. All our relatives had it. We gave it to favorite teachers, and there were corrections and additions that we added by hand over time. And I had so many friends and family members ask me, please rewrite the cookbook and add the pumpkin pie recipe that wasn't in there and so forth. And I thought about it for a number of years before I started the project. But I also realized, as I thought about it, that I lived in the house my grandparents had lived in Church Street for almost 50 years in downtown Charleston. And because my mother was an only child, she left the silver, the porcelains, the antique furniture in that house just as it had been in my grandparents' day. And so I had the opportunity not only to do the recipes, but to talk about her entertaining the years they spent in Charleston, 1940s to 1980s, and then to have it photographed in the house just as she would have set it up when she was entertaining during those years.
And you own the house now, and it's...
It's actually owned by the Church Street Historic Foundation. My grandparents set up a foundation in 1960 and gave the house to that foundation. Our lives, our lifetime is how it's measured, the lifetime of our generation, at which point it will go to Historic Charleston Foundation. And there's a provision that we can turn the house over sooner than that if we so choose.
Do you have siblings? Or is it just you?
No, I do have siblings. I have two younger brothers, neither of whom live in South Carolina. So I've had the privilege of carrying on these traditions since my grandmother's time.
Okay. Well, let's go back to your grandparents, because how these folks from up north came to fall in love with Charleston, settle there, and become an integral part of the community, particularly through the Historic Charleston Foundation, I think is a wonderful story. And in looking through the book, I found the line, your grandmother said that they were looking for a warmer climate, and they were going to look at Charleston, Savannah, and Mobile. Well, being from Mobile, I thought, well, why didn't they settle on the Gulf Coast? And then I found out why. And so you want to tell us why?
Well, my grandfather was a Yale-educated architect. He was very interested in preservation. And in those early years, in their youngish adulthood, that was the time that Williamsburg was being restored, and there was a great emphasis on preservation of these 18th century buildings. So in addition to looking for a warmer climate, I think what led them to consider those three cities was largely the architecture and history there. They came to Charleston, stayed at the Villa Margarita down on White Point Gardens, and they had a letter of introduction, as one did in those days, to a Charlestonian who then showed them around town. And on the first day, this gentleman mentioned that he was very excited to be able to show my grandfather this early Georgian house, and the lady of the house was going to meet them and show them through the house. And that was the Thomas Rose house that they subsequently bought. And it just happened, as they were saying goodbye to the lady at the front door, that she happened to mention to the Charleston gentleman whom she knew my husband has decided to sell the house and move back home. And my grandmother said that as soon as the door was closed, my grandfather put plans in motion to buy the house. And she always said it was many years later before they got to Savannah or Mobile. So who knows, Walter, if they had gone to Mobile first, they may have been in your hometown.
I could think of several places, and the Mobile of 1939 is far different from the Mobile of today. Incredible blocks of early 19th century architecture and everything that you could imagine that an antebellum city would have, and lots of cotton money made for big houses. But they didn't get there. They didn't get to Savannah with its squares. I could see the appeal of any of those cities, but being interested in architecture and a house from the 1730s, all of a sudden it's on the market. Hey, I wouldn't look any further either.
Right. It was meant to be somehow.
Yeah. Also later, your grandmother got a chance to expand the yard, and she did that on her own, right?
She did. My grandfather was on safari in Africa and completely out of touch. And the house next door, which had at one point belonged to the Thomas Rose house, came on the market. The lot had been subdivided, and this happened over time frequently as people, particularly as people needed money, they subdivided and sold off part of the property. And it had been done in 1840. At the time it came on the market, which was about 1953, it did have an 1840s house on it that they intended to restore and use as a guest house. They had their friend Luttrell Briggs, the well-known Charleston landscape architect, design an additional garden that would incorporate that property and use the 1840s house as a guest house. But when they got into it, they found that it was just riddled with termites and had to be torn down, at least according to 1953 regulations. They were allowed to do that.
It might have had, the Board of Architectural Review might have put up a few stoppers today.
Yes, might have felt differently today.
Yeah. So Luttrell Briggs' papers, I believe, are in the Historical Society. Are your grandmother's plans in the Historical Society?
They are. And what's particularly interesting is, I'm sure you know, I would say probably 10 years ago roughly, there was a move to really thoroughly document all of Luttrell Briggs' garden designs in Charleston. And I think this was done perhaps by a committee under the auspices of the Historic Charleston Foundation. They made an appointment with me to come see the garden, and they had the garden plans from the South Carolina Historical Society. And when they opened them up on the juggling board there on the piazza, I looked at them and was completely disoriented. And it turned out they had the plans, or the plans they had brought that day, were the plans when the guest house was still to be incorporated. Oh. And it was when that house was still standing on the property. None of that was executed, but it was interesting they had gotten as far as having him design it.
Do they have the later plan that actually came into existence?
Yes, they did. And we have copies of that as well.
And your garden today is pretty much that garden.
It is. It's very much what was designed in the mid-1950s. People ask about the oak trees. We have enormous, wonderful oak trees that we keep very carefully pruned and fertilized every year. We lost one oak tree during Hurricane Hugo, and they purchased a new tree, the biggest oak they could find, at Shady Grove Nurseries in Orangeburg, and steered the root ball through this enormous gate. The root ball was as wide as the gate, and it looks like it's been there for decades.
Okay, and so was this your parents, your grandparents?
My grandmother was still living during Hugo, but my mother and I were largely in charge of the house at that point.
Well, your grandmother not only was a fabulous cook, she also was a real gardener. And the soil of Charleston's kind of marshy, and it's not the best in the world. How'd she get around that to produce this flourishing landscape?
Well, she said that at the time they had, I think this was during the second phase of the garden, they had Luttrell Briggs design a tiny little pattern garden immediately behind the house when they first bought it. And when they bought the lot next door in the mid-50s, and he then incorporated that into a larger plan of various garden rooms, she said she brought in 3 feet of good John's Island topsoil, and she was convinced that's what accounted for the growth of the oak trees and everything else that's in there.
The results are obvious, and I think it's also interesting at a time when people still had a lot of help in Charleston, that she was still in the kitchen herself. She still was in the garden herself. Like her neighbor, Emily Whaley, she worked in the garden. She may have had help, but she did a lot of the work herself.
She did. She had, again, various rooms of the formal garden. She had a greenhouse in the back, an area she called her cutting garden that was kind of hidden behind a wall so that if things were blooming in season, she could cut things and use them in arrangements in the house that weren't necessarily going to be obvious to someone walking through the formal garden. And she always had what she called her salad garden. And that was back in the area behind the formal garden as well. And I remember as a young child when we would come to visit often for Easter, and we lived in Ohio at that time where my father's business was, she would have strawberries growing. And she had what I think is today called a strawberry tower that formed the center of the bed with concentric circles that went up as taller than I was at the time. And, you know, for us to have left the snow and slush and run out in the Charleston sunshine in the garden and pick fresh strawberries right there in the garden was just such a treat. It was something I'll always remember.
All right, so your grandparents settled in Charleston, but then when your mother married, she moved back to up north.
Up north, yes. My grandparents moved to Charleston from Connecticut. My grandmother had grown up in West Virginia, largely. My grandfather had grown up in New York, and they were living in Connecticut. And my mother was an only child, as was my grandfather. And the reason I mention that is just that all these recipes, all my grandmother's time as a grandmother and a mentor, and all the contents of the house, the furniture, the porcelains and so forth, have all come down without being broken up among multiple siblings until our generation. It's meant there's this repository that's all with one person in each generation for 100 years or more. My mother was married at St. Michael's Church in Charleston in 1950, and my father's business was in the bicycle manufacturing business, had been founded by his father in Ohio. So as soon as they were married, they left and moved to Ohio. And when I was 13, they had a manufacturing plant in Southern California, and we moved there. And my mother lived there the rest of her life until Thanksgiving weekend of last year, just 2014, when she passed away in California. She always said that if my father died first, she would want to move back to Charleston because she thought it was a much friendlier city for an older person. She remembered my grandmother walking everywhere. She walked to the post office, to her accountant, to her bank. But when the time came, Mother always said, well, I'm not ready yet. I have too many things I like to do out here. So I've been the one
in Charleston. How did you end up in Charleston?
Well, as I said, being the only grandchildren, we had spent a lot of time with my Charleston grandparents over the years. We were very close to them and spent time in the North Carolina mountains with them in the summers as well. And I graduated from Stanford University in Northern California, felt very Californian at that time, moved to Vienna, Austria for 2 years, where I worked, had my first jobs out of college. And then after a couple of years, I was really ready to come back to the U.S., but I didn't know whether I wanted to go to graduate school, where I wanted to live, what I wanted to do. And my grandmother said, well, why don't you come to Charleston for 6 months or so while you decide? And that was in October of 1976. And I'm still here and firmly a South Carolinian at this stage. Charleston worked its magic, as it has on a lot of people.
That's a great story. I really like what you said about your grandmother, remembering that Charleston was such a, you could walk. It was a walking city. That's how you know the city.
That is. And that's what I tell people who are visiting when they say, what should we do? I said, well, the biggest thing you need to do, and you can do at no cost, is just walk the neighborhoods.
That's right. You can get a good map. You don't need a guided tour. No offense to the folks who give guided tours, but if you really just want to soak up Charleston for a couple of days, just walk.
Very true.
And your family over the years has been very generous about opening up the house on Church Street to various organizations. Obviously, the Historic Charleston Foundation, and I think your grandparents were instrumental in the organization of that particular group.
They were, and again, I think a lot of that comes from that beginnings of Historic Williamsburg at that time, and people who were interested in preservation and early architecture were, I think, so excited by that movement. My grandfather was also got immediately involved in the Carolina Art Association when they moved here. And it's interesting because the Carolina Art Association was very active at that time in a very broad way. They owned the Gibbs Museum. They ran the Gibbs Museum. I think the city actually owns it or owns it partly. But in reading back through some materials that were written at that time, I was fascinated that it wasn't just the Gibbs Museum. They did a study, for example, in the 40s or 50s.
This is Charleston, the little book of architecture.
They did This Is Charleston, which was the directory of significant architecture in the city. But they also did a study to look at creating off-street parking behind the businesses along King Street. And that did not proceed. And I found a quote from someone who was writing about the history of the Carolina Art Association in 1958. And even in 1958, people were lamenting the fact that this parking plan hadn't been implemented. Mm-hmm. So I think that parking and issues like that have been a long time.
It's an issue that Charleston and all other towns who, I should say cities, that want to keep some kind of historic ambience are having a struggle with. New Orleans particularly, they've got a real issue with
it. And I was just in New Orleans last weekend, so. Yeah.
Now, your granddad was pretty much a purist. Is it true that he wouldn't put in central heat and air?
Yes, that is true. He felt, and again, this was the 40s and 50s, maybe early 60s, but he felt that the forced air would have a detrimental effect on the paneling. The house is, 90% of it still has the original paneling from the 1735 construction. So that was his primary reason for not doing it. As long as my grandmother lived there, which was up to 1988, she put the house away for the summer. And she had help who were there in the summer when she was in the mountains. So they kept the attic fan going. They kept the windows open. But the rugs were all rolled up and put away. The curtains came down.
White linen covers for the furniture.
Everything was covered. In fact, I still have a huge carton of slip covers that were made, the final set that was made in the late 80s, for not only the upholstered furniture, but the cabinetry in the house each had its own custom slip cover.
Closing up the house for the summer, or if you stayed there, changing everything. I grew up in a house in Mobile, and the cousins who had owned it before had not only did what you're talking about, they rolled up the rugs, put down rushes, but they changed, the silver went up, they brought out porcelain crystal. In other words, they changed everything because of the climate. But I gather now the house is air-conditioned.
It is. We put the first, we air-conditioned about half of it in the late 90s and the early 2000s, we did the other half. Prior to that, there were a few window air conditioning units in some of the key rooms, but we didn't have central heating either. So when we went to do that, it meant putting in the ductwork while being respectful of the historic fabric of the house.
Did you use the chimneys? That's what some people do.
We used some areas that had originally been pass-throughs that had been made into closets. Half bath on the first floor was shrunken. The half bath on the third floor is now two-thirds of the size it was. So nooks and crannies.
Well, see, some people don't realize the difficulty with living in a historic house. And in this case, with your grandfather being so insistent on protecting the integrity of the paneling, sometimes you got to cut through walls, and that makes it difficult.
Exactly. That we have a crawl space under the house, so for the first system we put in the late 90s, the ductwork went under there, and then there are knee walls on the third floor around the dormer rooms, which are now filled with ductwork.
You're still in Charleston, but you're also in Camden.
I am. Several years ago, my brothers and I talked about long-term plans for the house after my mother was no longer living. It was very important to her to keep it, to open it to the public, to respect what her parents wanted, to protect the paneling and so forth. And so after we talked about it, I thought, well, if we turn over the house to Historic Charleston earlier rather than wait till the end of our lifetimes, I'm the one who's going to have to find a new place to live, and where might that be? And years ago, my children and I rode horses and did some of the hunter jumper shows around the state and were introduced to Camden as part of the horse world. And I just had wonderful memories of it. So I drove back to Camden and spent a couple days just driving around and saying, I really like the feel of this little town. And I ended up buying a house there about 5 years ago. And the funny story with that is I bumped into Mayor Riley in Charleston one day at lunch. I had known him since the first year of Spoleto, 1977. And he said to me, now, did I hear you bought a house in the mountains? And I said, no, actually, it was Camden. And I was specific because I knew that's where his wife had grown up. And he said, well, why Camden? And I said, well, I feel a little funny saying this to you of all people, but I think I'm looking for a place that was like Charleston was when I moved here 30 years ago. And he was a little baffled by that. But I was thinking of this when you mentioned knowing your neighbors. Mm-hmm. Parts of Charleston, and the part where our house is, particularly the eastern part of the peninsula, the real estate prices have skyrocketed. The young people who grew up there can no longer afford to live there. There are often houses that are owned by people from New York or whatever who want a second home or a third home.
A trophy house.
And so I just find in recent years that I don't really know my neighbors so much. And, of course, my grandmother in her day, if there was a new neighbor, she immediately gave a Sunday luncheon for 30 people to all meet the new neighbor. We don't do that anymore. And I found in coming to Camden that being a smaller town, it's very much that way. People know, and I spent my first few years going back and forth between Camden and Charleston, and my neighbors would always tell me, oh, I saw a car coming out of your driveway. Is someone supposed to be there? Do you have a workman coming this week? The lights were on late. My poor painter was there painting inside the house till midnight, and the neighbors got in touch with me to make sure that was someone who was supposed to be there. And just recently, we had some things moved from my mother's house in California, and I met the movers in Camden, and one of my dear friends sent me an email the night before and said, unless you tell me otherwise, I'm bringing lunch for you tomorrow when the movers come. You know, it's all those wonderful interactions that you have in a small town.
Well, let's talk about social customs and traditions, if you will. You mentioned your grandmother in the 40s and 50s. If a new person moved into the neighborhood, she had a luncheon for 30 people. Now, I know there is a large dining room in the house, but how do you handle 30 people for lunch?
Well, 30 was always her limit, whether it was one of her black tie dinner parties or the Sunday lunch in the garden. And the reason was that if she had to move it inside, either under the piazzas, if it were the right time of year, or into the living room and library, 30 was the maximum capacity of those rooms. She had tables and folding chairs for that number of people that she kept in the storeroom. The tables sat six. They were fairly small, little round tables. Anytime possible, it would be set up in the garden. And she did a lot of the cooking herself. She would, for example, have a cook there who might brown all the chicken breasts for 30 people, which, having done it numerous times, I can tell you takes a long time. And then my grandmother would come in and finish with the sauce. So she did a lot of dishes like that. She would make the, as she called, tomato aspic in the giant ring mold, and that would be refrigerated ahead of time. And then she, because she entertained so often, her help, who had been with her for a number of years, knew the routine, knew about setting up the tables and where the buffet was and so forth.
And if they had to do it in the house, she'd just move things around.
She would. In fact, I was talking just recently with somebody who had had this experience at her house. We, in the first floor, sitting room and the little library adjacent, if it were December party or January, she would have the furniture moved out of those rooms ahead of time and put on the side piazza with covered in dust sheets. And then all the tables would be set up inside. Well, when the guests were invited, they came to the front door and they were walked through that room where the dining tables were to the second floor formal drawing room where we had cocktails before dinner. Then we'd go downstairs for dinner, and then we would adjourn finally back to the second floor drawing room for after dinner drinks, at which point everything would be tidied up and the furniture would be moved back into those front rooms. And when my grandmother or I would say goodnight to people at the door of the drawing room upstairs, I can't tell you the number of times a couple would say their goodnights, head downstairs, and then come back with this embarrassed look and say, "We thought we knew how we had come in. We thought we knew how to find the front door, but we went down there, and it's a different room now." So we laughed about that.
We need to pause a moment, Catherine, to let our listeners know that I'm talking to Catherine Forrester about her book, At Home, Charleston. Let's talk about now some recipes, and we were talking earlier about the entertaining and 30 was the limit. Today, people are pretty slack. If you're invited for dinner at 7, sometimes people will show up at 7:30, what have you. Your grandmother was, and older generations in general, were pretty, if you were invited for 7, there was not a 2-hour cocktail party ahead of time. You were invited for a drink, and dinner was promptly at either 7:30 or 7:45.
That's right. And my grandmother very much adhered to that, and it caught a number of people unawares over the years, some of whom you would know, Walter, but I won't name them, who arrived just as we were sitting down. We'd already finished drinks upstairs in the drawing room. People were getting their plates at the buffet and finding their places at the individual tables, and the doorbell would ring, and there would be the one couple who had not arrived at 7.
Your grandmother kept a very accurate list. Did she make a note? Did they go on the black? Did they get blacklisted?
You know, of the couples I know who did that during my years there, I don't think they were blacklisted.
That they learned a lesson.
Yes, yes. Probably the embarrassment factor was enough that they wouldn't do it again.
And you have an interesting quotation. Your grandmother didn't have cocktail parties.
No, she did not. She entertained so constantly that, you know, we all still get into this mindset that we owe someone, someone who's had us for a party of some sort, and we have to have them within the year because we owe them for that invitation. And my grandmother referred to them, the big cocktail parties, as sweepouts, where somebody would just want to pay back all their friends who had had them in the course of a year, and they would do one big cocktail party at the yacht club, and that was a sweepout, and then you could start all over. And she really, what was important to her was conversation, and so many of her events that are in the entertaining journals were if there was a new director at the Gibbs Museum or a new minister and his wife at St. Michael's. Those were the occasions that she would often build, and largely perhaps a smaller party. Mm-hmm. But she entertained with a purpose, I suppose you would say.
And you have a quote in here about defining a cocktail party. Tell us what your grandmother thought about cocktail parties.
Well, in one of her leather party journals, she had taped a quote, which she had cut out from somewhere, that said, "A cocktail party is one at which one attains the maximum physical movement with the minimum mental activity. It is also a place where you talk with a person you do not know about a subject in which you have no interest." And that, I think, was her philosophy for her whole life.
And so that's where the sweepouts.
That's where the sweepouts, yes. And she would go happily with a smile on her face, but she wasn't going to reciprocate in that manner.
My parents had an older friend who referred to those as fanny bumpers because there were so many people crowded into the room.
Yes, exactly. I like that term, too.
Well, let's talk recipes, family traditions. And I think, you know, when you said it starts dinner party conversation, so the guest list is very important. Every dinner party your grandmother had, she wrote down what she had on the menu. Seating plans. So, I mean, this is just not a, you know, everybody find your own place kind of thing. And can you tell whether she designed the menu for a particular person? Was she introducing somebody? Like if folks came, family came from Ohio or wherever, she would make sure they got a good taste of Charleston?
I think she did do that in some cases, but I think she wanted to serve her recipes. People came back, and I can't tell you, today even, I have people who say, "Oh, I just loved your grandmother's tomato aspic, and I never get that anymore." And if I serve it today, people my age, maybe not my children's age, but people my age will walk in and be thrilled to have it. But she did serve a lot of fish, shrimp frequently, shrimp and crab. My grandfather was an avid hunter, and even after his death, she had friends of his who would appear. One gentleman who rang the doorbell every morning in the middle of Christmas morning, and we would roll our eyes, but we knew exactly who it was, and that was their gift to her after my grandfather's death, to bring her quail or duck or venison or whatever they had had from their shooting parties. So those were very much part of her repertoire as well.
Your grandmother's in the kitchen. When you were growing up in California, did your mother continue those traditions?
My mother was a good cook. She entertained beautifully. She did that more so in the earlier years when we were in Ohio, and primarily because that was the corporate headquarters of the company. They had a lot of international visitors who would come through, and so she would often do the entertaining on that side. When we got to California, I think after being a young housewife with a great brain. She went to Smith College and majored in international relations and spent a year in Geneva in 1949, right after the war. She was so thrilled to have the kids a little older and to move to a larger environment where she could be involved in more things and could check out all the restaurants. So in later years, I would say, since I was about high school or maybe since I went away to college, she didn't do quite as much at home.
So really, your love of the entertaining and cooking came when you moved, your grandmother, when you moved to Charleston, to discover yourself, and you stayed.
Right. I can picture visits from my grandmother, my grandparents early on, and then in later years, just my grandmother. And she would often do special dishes when she was there. And I remember just standing with her at the stove, and she would show me exactly how to make something. One time, I remember vaguely, I must have been 8 or 10, and we were still living in Ohio. And I decided during one of my grandparents' visits that I was going to surprise them and my parents by making, I think it was a coffee cake for breakfast before they got up. And those were the old days where you had to turn on the gas on the oven and then light it with a match. And I think I had a little more gas than I needed, and the whole thing went poof, and I ended up, fortunately, with nothing more than singed eyebrows. But I did start cooking really at a younger age, and then just learned so much from her. And in the summers, in later years, after I was living in the Carolinas, I would go to North Carolina, and we grew our own blueberries and raspberries. We could supplement those with other locally grown fruits. And so that's where I really got into jam making.
Oh, okay. Well, you mentioned earlier that one of your grandmother's favorite recipes was her aspic. She served that. A very traditional, you know, growing up in Mobile, I can't remember my mother or grandmother going to a luncheon, ladies' luncheon, where that was not either the big ring or sometimes the individual.
Mm-hmm.
The individuals. Another variation of that was the cherry salad, the Coca-Cola.
Yes.
Salad.
Yes.
And you say you don't see those kind of foods being served much anymore.
Well, I think each generation and each decade perhaps goes through cycles of, you know, what people serve and enjoy. I mean, I can remember back in the 70s or 80s, the big thing was this bread that was made with, I think, cottage cheese and dill, and everybody made it. And I, you know, haven't had that for eons. So I think things like that do cycle through. But, you know, when she did it, I was just at a dinner party a couple months ago with some friends, and two of the women began talking about my grandmother's aspic recipe. And one of them had said, oh, well, my husband loves tomato aspic, and I make it, but I'm really not happy with it. It's a little rubbery, and blah, blah, blah. And the other friend said, well, haven't you made Mrs. Stott's aspic? It's in Kathy's book, which I know you must have. And so the friend went back and made that for her husband, and she said, I'm never going to make another tomato aspic in my life because that's just perfect. So, but I don't know that my children and their generation would want it.
Well, mutual friends, the Lee brothers, and we've talked about changes in cooking, have various theories. One is not just the fact that people are in a bigger hurry today, but what is marketed in the food stores. My wife loves fresh spinach, or even used to be frozen spinach. You can't find the plain anymore. Everything is pre-made with a sauce this and a sauce that. And she just said it's so difficult just to find plain spinach to use in a recipe. And that's the way things are packaged and marketed. Natalie Dupree says the chicken breast you buy today, you can't fry them because they're too plump.
They're enormous. And I do find one of the things that my grandmother always made to serve at Christmas time was her wonderful plum pudding recipe. And about 15 years ago or so, I went to make it, and I couldn't find good beef suet. And I even tried with some of the chefs in Charleston to say, well, if you ever get a whole cow and you're butchering it, as they now sometimes do, and maybe split between two restaurants, I'd love to have that suet. Because I can make it at any time of year and, mm-hmm. and put it in the freezer. But that's one of the ingredients that I just can't find anymore.
Well, what advice do you have for a young hostess today, let's just say somewhere in South Carolina, but she wants to do a nice dinner party for 8 or 10?
Well, I've had a lot of people tell me since the book came out that they have recreated entire menus from it, and everything worked perfectly, and people loved it and enjoyed it. So I think that's possible. It depends on how well a person cooks. As my mother said one time about one of our relatives, and I said I sent them a recipe that I thought was simple, and it turned out wrong. And she said, well, honey, if you tell somebody, you have to start by creaming the butter and sugar, and they don't know what that means, then it's not going to be a simple recipe for them. So I think many of these recipes are apparently simple. There's nothing complicated about most of them. Many of them can be done in advance, either a few days in advance and have in the refrigerator ready to go. They can be done weeks in advance and be in the freezer ready to go. And all that makes your entertaining so much easier once your guests are there.
It is. And of course, you know, some people like to entertain out of the kitchen, you know, to watch people cook. But there is something very nice about a dinner party where conversation is there and you bring out the china and the silver and you do it right.
It really sets the tone for things, I think. And it's been interesting since my mother passed away last year and we've talked about which family members wanted different things. I have one brother who stayed in Southern California. My bachelor brother lives in the mountains in North Carolina. And then there's me and my two children. Well, the rest of the family doesn't entertain that way anymore. And they don't want the silver. And they don't want crystal or china that they have to hand wash. And I do understand that largely that's the way things go in the nation these days. But I will say that my children have said, of course we want some of those. We grew up with them. And, you know, we want to maintain that lifestyle and that way of family entertaining.
Well, that's good. And it's interesting to talk about your siblings don't particularly care about what silver or china. Go into a small family jewelry store today. Columbia has several still. Mobile has several. Used to be they would have literally a dining room table displaying the china, crystal, silver for brides. Most of them don't even carry that anymore. They really have just become jewelry and watch stores, especially silver. You can go to an auction, and unless it's a really exceptional piece, it's being sold for whatever silver's bringing per ounce.
Exactly,
that day.
Exactly.
Which means yes, it goes.
I've reluctantly learned that over the last year. But I'm happy because I have a lot of these things that I've enjoyed in my grandparents' house or my mother's house and that my kids have grown up seeing and or using. And so if my brothers don't want it, that's wonderful because I get to have it and enjoy it and remember all the stories that go along with it.
I think that's it. That's important. Neil and I, as we have dispersed things to children, make sure the children understood the history of a piece, whether it was furniture or what have you, because that makes a difference.
It does, and I think not just with the pieces you're using, but also with the recipes. And that's what I found in this book. And one time I was giving a talk and I was asked at the end, what do you think your grandmother would be most pleased about in your having done this book? And I said, I think she would be most pleased to know that the next generation cherishes those recipes and looks forward to them every Thanksgiving, and that continuity is there. But there are always stories, you know, this recipe came from my great-grandmother, their great-great-grandmother in some cases. And the same way with the pieces you're using. Whose china was it? What house had it been used in before? What occasions did you bring out a certain set?
It used to be when an organization brought a cookbook, might be the Junior League, it might be a church, it might be a school, they would say at the end whose recipe it was. My daughter was on the committee for the Boston League cookbook, and they didn't put anybody's name. And she said, this isn't right. And they said, well, they're just recipes. And I've noticed even Southern cookbooks, some of them have been coming out now, they don't say Catherine Forrester's tomato aspic.
Yes. Well, in the old days, they wouldn't have said it quite that way because it would have been Mrs. Henry P. Stotts rather than Juliet Stotts' recipe for something.
Well,
to take it a notch further.
But I often think the success of those older cookbooks that came out in the 40s, 50s, and 60s was people knew, I mean, Charleston Receipts, Jubilee Recipe from Mobile, if it was Mrs. Duke's, if it was Florence Duke's recipe, everybody knew that it was no fail and it would be absolutely delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe that tells us people aren't in the kitchen as much as they used to, despite the fact the books are coming out. Take one of your parties, and if you would sort of share it with our listeners as, you know, the setup, the menu, that kind of thing.
Well, as you said earlier, my grandmother would always include the seating arrangement, not only who was present, but who was unable to attend. Here's a dinner party in 1965. This would have been one of her larger ones. She served a cold ribeye of beef, cold Virginia ham, tomato aspic ring with cottage cheese, asparagus spears, and homemade mayonnaise, avocado with French dressing, a scalloped oyster casserole, hard rolls. Dessert was a chocolate mousse with meringues and Benny cookies, demi-tasse, and mince and ginger, candied ginger, that were passed around. She says the dinner went very well. The food was perfectly prepared, had red and white camellias and bowl of white stock and blue iris, red camellias in the drawing room. Everyone seemed to enjoy the evening. And then under table decorations, she gives some more detail of where the tables were and which silver she used with it and so forth.
This is a hard question to ask you. What is your favorite recipe out of the book?
Oh, I think today, I might answer you differently another day, but today I think the pumpkin pie.
Okay. And would you read the recipe for us?
Oh, I'd love to. The pumpkin pie was a family favorite that was not in the original cookbook. This pumpkin pie recipe, I believe, came from my mother's mother. So we've been using it for a number of generations now. It's two eggs at room temperature, 2 cups of canned stewed pumpkin, which is not the pumpkin pie mix that already is sweetened mm-hmm. and had. You don't want that, just the plain pumpkin. 2 tablespoons of butter melted, 1 cup of cream, 1 cup of sugar, 1 teaspoon of salt, 1/8 teaspoon of nutmeg, 1/4 teaspoon of ginger, 1/2 teaspoon of powdered cloves, and 2 teaspoons of cinnamon. You prepare a pie crust, then you separate the eggs. This is what I think, 2 things I think make this pie different. One is that the eggs are separated and you beat the egg whites until they're stiff and fold them into the pumpkin mixture. And also it has a lot more spice than a lot of pies have. In a large bowl, combine the pumpkin, melted butter, cream, egg yolks, sugar, and spices, and mix well. Beat the egg whites until stiff but not dry and fold into the pumpkin mixture. Pour into prepared crust and bake for about an hour at 350 until the knife inserted in the center comes out clean. And the thing my grandmother always did, now I love to make this on Thanksgiving morning, partly just because the house smells so wonderful after it's baked. But this can be made ahead and frozen before it's baked. And you pull it out of the freezer and let it sit at room temperature for about 10 minutes and then bake it while it's still frozen. So again, that's something for entertaining that can be done well ahead of time.
Do you add whipped cream when you serve it?
We're purists. We do not.
Okay.
Sometimes the relatives want the whipped cream, and I will acquiesce, but my children and I prefer it just as is.
Okay. Well, Alfred's giving me the wind-up sign. Kathy, is there anything you'd like to add for our listeners before we do?
Well, I think knowing that you commonly ask that question, I had thought a little about what I would say. And I guess there's a move currently, and Matt and Ted Lee talk about this a lot as well, to not lose the family recipes and the home cook's interpretation of what local or regional cooking is. We're all thrilled with the new restaurants, and every restaurant wants to do their twist or their riff on, in Charleston, it might be shrimp and grits. And I think it's great that people are trying these old dishes in new ways, and largely the restaurant chefs. But I also think it's just so much a part of our tradition, our social fabric, that we have these old recipes that come down through generations. And I think it's important to keep them.
I agree. Catherine Forrester, author of At Home Charleston, thanks for being with us today on the Journal.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. Catherine Forrester wrote At Home Charleston about 10 years ago, but I just discovered it through mutual friends who mentioned it. And it's more than just a cookbook. It's a memoir. It's a family history. And it really is a mirror of a lifestyle from the 1940s through the 1980s. It is a fascinating peek into the past. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.